get quiet. Wintry Mix is radically unromantic, as nicely captured by the word grapple. Wintry mix is a thoroughly Midwestern form of precipitation, practical, unlovely, and unpretentious. As I pile withered bean bushes into the wheelbarrow, I feel like the sky is spitting on me. I think of Wilson Bentley, the amateur photographer from Vermont who became the first person to take a close-up photograph of a snowflake in 1885. Bentley went on to photograph more than 5,000 snowflakes, which he called ice flowers and tiny miracles of beauty. Nobody ever called grapple a tiny miracle of beauty, and obviously, I don't love being pelted by tiny balls of freezing rain or having sleet lash at me from seemingly impossible angles as it blows across the flat and unbroken misery of an Indiana field. And yet, I do kind of like Wintry Mix. It's one of the ways I know that I'm home. I love Indianapolis precisely because it isn't easy to love. You have to stay here a while to know its beauty. You have to learn to read the clouds as something more than threatening or dreary. The words pathetic fallacy sound derogatory, and the phrase was originally intended as such when coined by the critic John Ruskin. Of romantic poets like Scott and Wordsworth, Ruskin wrote, "The love of nature is more or less associated with their weakness." He would go on to claim that endowing nature with emotion is always the sign of a morbid state of mind and comparatively a weak one. Side note, Ruskin's obsession with strength and weakness in poetry, and the assumption that strength is inherently better than weakness, which in my opinion is a fundamental misunderstanding of the human situation, serves as a stark reminder that the forces of colonialist thinking in English literature stretched so deep into everything that there's no separating, there or anywhere, art from ideology. Maybe it's owing to my comparatively weak and morbid state of mind, but the pathetic fallacy often works for me. I like it when Wordsworth wanders lonely as a cloud, or when Scott writes of nature having a genial glow. Many of us really are affected by the weather, especially in the slimly lit days of winter. The weather may not have human emotions, but it does cause them. Also, we can't help but see the world around us in the context of ourselves, especially our emotional selves. That's not a bug of human consciousness, but a feature of it. And so, yes, of course, precipitation is utterly indifferent to us. As E.E. Cummings put it, the snow doesn't give a soft white damn whom it touches. And yes, how grateful we are to the modernists for knocking down our doors to inform us that clouds do not threaten or weep, that the only verb a cloud ever verbed was to be. But we give a soft white dam whom snow touches. Walking the wheelbarrow full of dead, uprooted plants toward our compost pile, I remember a snippet of an Ann Carson poem. The first snows of winter floated down on his eyelashes and covered the branches around him and silenced all trace of the world. But there is no silence here in the land of Wintry Mix, only the cacophonous tit-a-tat white noise of grapple bombarding the ground. The groundhog sleeps through it all. When she gets going in late March, she'll feel the same, and I will feel different. The month the groundhog wakes up, Sarah's book tour will be canceled. Our kids' schools will close. We will be separated from friends and family for what, at first, we think might be 4 weeks, or even 8. I will suddenly become far more interested in the garden than I've ever been, And that spring, I will learn of a solution to the great groundhog war from watching, of all things, a YouTube video. It turns out I am not the only person to be locked in conflict with a groundhog, and another gardener suggests a radical solution that works perfectly. I till a patch of soil by the shed, and when I am done planting soybean seeds in my garden, I plant some in the groundhog's garden. The same with the peppers and the beans. Beginning that March, I will be outside all the time, every day, ravenous for the normalcy that I can only feel outdoors, where nature proceeds apace. I will begin to understand, for the first time in my life, that I am not just made for Earth, but also of it. But we are not there yet. The menacing spring has not yet sprouted. I dump the dead plants into a compost pile and return the wheelbarrow to the shed. That night, Sarah and I will listen to the poet Paige Lewis read. I love Lewis's book Space Struck for many reasons, but especially because the poems give voice and form to the anxiety that dominates so much of my life, the panic of threatening clouds and scornful groundhogs. In one poem, Lewis writes of a narrator who feels as if I'm on the moon listening to the air hiss out of my spacesuit and I can't find the hole. I'm the vice president of panic, and the president is missing. In March of 1965, the cosmonaut Alexei Leonov exited the Mir space capsule and became the first human being to float freely in space. At the end of this first spacewalk, Leonov discovered that his spacesuit had expanded in the vacuum of space, and he could not squeeze back into the capsule. His only choice was to open a valve in the spacesuit and let the air within seep out into space, which shrank the suit enough that he could squeeze back into the spaceship just before his oxygen ran out. Nature is indifferent to us, but surely it did not feel that way to Alexei Leonov as he felt the air leak out and the void rush in. I don't believe we have a choice when it comes to whether we endow the world with meaning. We are all little fairies sprinkling meaning dust everywhere we go. This mountain will mean God, and that precipitation will mean trouble. The vacuum of space will mean emptiness, and the groundhog will mean nature's scorn for human absurdity. We will build meaning wherever we go, with whatever we come across. But to me, while making meaning isn't a choice, the kind of meaning can be. I came in from the garden. I took a shower, and the water prickled my frozen skin. I got dressed, parted my hair to the side with a comb, and drove with Sarah through a treacherous evening of wintry mix to the poetry reading. We talked about her book and about our kids. After a while, she turned the radio on. On another night, the same weather would have been threatening or menacing or joyless. But not tonight. What you're looking at matters, but not as much as how you're looking or who you're looking with. That night, I was with just the right person, in just the right place, and I'll be damned if the grapple wasn't beautiful. I give Wintry Mix 4 stars.
The Hot Dogs of Bayern's Bestu Pilser. In the summer of 2008, Sarah and I traveled to Europe with another couple, our friends Laura and Ryan. I like Laura and Ryan a lot, but one thing you need to know is that they are the sort of people who really try to suck the marrow out of life and make the most of their brief flicker of consciousness and all that stuff. This is quite different from my style of traveling, wherein I spend most of the day psyching myself up to do one thing, visit a museum, perhaps, and the rest of the day recovering from the only event on my itinerary. The trip took us from Denmark to Sweden and then on to Iceland, a small and mostly rocky island nation in the North Atlantic that attracts tourists primarily by offering free stopovers to anyone who flies Iceland's national airline, Iceland Air. I was interested in visiting Iceland because, one, it has a population under 400,000, and I've long been fascinated by tiny nations and how they make it work. And two, my longtime publisher, Julie Strauss-Gable, is a frequent visitor to Iceland and had vociferously recommended a certain hot dog stand in Reykjavik. The trips to Sweden and Denmark had been lovely. There were smorgasbords and museums, but the highlight had been an evening spent with Ryan's Swedish relatives, who lived on the shores of some endless lake in the wilderness. They welcomed us to their home and proceeded to get us blisteringly, unprecedentedly drunk on Sweden's national liquor, Bronvin. I do not often drink to excess because I have an intense fear of hangovers, but I made an exception that evening. Ryan's relatives taught us Swedish drinking songs, and they taught us how to eat pickled herring, and my glass kept getting filled with Bronvin, until at last the 80-year-old patriarch of the family stood up and spoke his first English words of the evening. "And now, the sauna." So we got in the sauna, and I was so drunk that I was pouring cold beer over my head to stay cool in the sauna. And then, after a while, Sarah and I stepped outside and walked knee-deep into the lake. The 80-year-old patriarch, whose name was, I think, Lasse, joined us, and he was standing there, completely nude, next to the ridiculously modest Americans in their bathing suits. And then Lasse clapped me on the back in what was intended to be a firm gesture of camaraderie. Unprepared for the strength of his embrace, I fell face first into the lake. I was uninjured, but my glasses were thoroughly and irreparably scratched from an encounter with the rocks in the lake bed. The next morning, I woke up reminded that my abject fear of hangovers is fully warranted, and also unable to see much on account of the gouged glasses. By the time we arrived in Reykjavik, Iceland, 2 days later, I was still hungover, which for me always means a sour churning in the left side of my abdomen combined with a general desire to dissolve into the landscape. This is the real crux of a hangover for me. Alcohol consumption increases my vulnerability to despair. I understood that it was only the hangover talking, but the hangover does talk rather loudly. Hangovers also make me quite sensitive to light, which would have been a problem, except that it was a hideously gray morning when we landed in Reykjavik, not just overcast, but misty. It was one of those days where you realize that sky is just another human construct, that the sky starts wherever the ground ends. Sky isn't just something way up out there, but also something that your head is swimming in all the time. We took a taxi from the airport into the city of Reykjavik, Iceland's largest and really only city. The cab driver was listening to some kind of Icelandic talk radio that was turned up entirely too loud, and I was squeezed between Sarah and Laura in the back seat. As we entered the city, I was struck mostly by its eerie silence. There was not a single person out on the streets, even though the weather wasn't that bad. It was a Friday in summer, and I had imagined a small city where people walked all day to the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker or whatever. Instead, the town was utterly still. About four blocks from our hotel, the cab driver said, "This is good." He stopped and asked us to pay him. We expressed an interest in his driving us all the way to our hotel, but he said, "No, it is too much. It is too much, what do you say, too much stress." From my perspective, it didn't seem too stressful to drive on those empty streets, but whatever, I'm not an expert in Icelandic driving. We got out of the cab and began wheeling our suitcases down a wide, abandoned sidewalk in central Reykjavik. What I remember most is the sound of our suitcase wheels on the sidewalk's stone tiles, the noise overwhelming amid such silence. And then, from nowhere and everywhere simultaneously, came a shout, followed by a groan. The entire city, hidden somewhere inside the buildings all around us, seemed to have made the exact same noise at the exact same moment. "That was weird," Ryan said, and we began speculating on why the city was locked down. Maybe there'd been some kind of weather threat that tourists weren't made aware of. Maybe it was a national indoor holiday. "Maybe," Laura said, "they're all watching the same thing on TV." And at that moment, the city's silence burst apart. A tremendous roar erupted all around us. People poured out of every doorway, out of homes and stores and bars, and into the streets. They were screaming in exultation, all of them, yelling, "Yah!" Many of them had their faces painted in the colors of the Icelandic flag, and quite a lot of them were openly weeping. A tall fellow around my age picked me up and held me up to the sky like I was Simba in The Lion King, and then embraced me as he wept. Someone draped a scarf around Ryan's neck. "What the hell is happening?" Sarah asked with her trademark precision. Beers were handed around. We took some. The initial chaos of screaming soon organized itself into song, songs that were apparently very emotional because everyone except for us was crying as they sang in the streets. Some people had to sit down on the curbs in order to sob properly. The crowd continued to swell. There are 120,000 people in Reykjavik, and they were all on the streets, all seemingly on this street. Making it to our hotel was an impossibility now. We were in the throng amidst some great wave of human experience, and all we could hope for was to hold on to our suitcases. As one song ended and everyone began to shout again, I decided to try it myself. I lifted my unopened can of beer into the air and shouted, "Yah!" Although I did not know what we were celebrating, I felt exultant. I loved Iceland. I loved Reykjavik. I loved these people whose tears and sweat smudged their red, white, and blue face paint. Eventually, we were able to ascertain that Iceland had just secured its first ever team Olympic medal in the sport of men's handball. I found myself wondering what event in my home country might lead to such shared celebrations. Cities celebrate when their teams win the World Series or the Super Bowl, but the only time I'd seen any public celebrations of a national event was in 1999, when the U.S. women's national soccer team won the World Cup. I was living in the small town of Moose Pass, Alaska, that summer, working at a cafe. My colleagues and I were watching the game on a tiny TV in the corner of the shop, and after Brandi Chastain scored the winning penalty kick, I heard horns honking, and then a couple minutes later, a single voice from somewhere in Moose Pass shouted, "Fuck yes, America!" I didn't know much about men's team handball. It is rarely on American TV and one of the only Olympic sports that the U.S. does not regularly participate in. But I am willing to get excited about almost anything in sports. And by the time we got to the hotel a couple hours later, I considered myself a die-hard fan of Icelandic men's team handball. I wanted to rest in the hotel and perhaps watch some highlights. The excitement of my beloved team winning an Olympic medal had exhausted me. But my compatriots insisted that we go out and soak in some Icelandic culture. The crowd had thinned considerably, and it was still early in the day, so we visited a museum where we learned that because the Icelandic language has changed so little over the centuries, their classic sagas read like contemporary literature. We saw the chess table where Bobby Fischer defeated Boris Spassky in 1972. Later, we took a tour bus trip to the island's interior, where endless plains of volcanic rock make it feel like you're on another planet. Our tour guide extolled Iceland's many virtues. "In Greenland, it is always icy," she said. "But here in Iceland, the weather is quite mild. They should call Iceland Greenland and Greenland Iceland." Then we all got out of the bus to observe a waterfall. It was 50 degrees Fahrenheit in August, and a cold rain was blowing at us horizontally, rendering umbrellas utterly useless. Shouting to be heard over the wind, the tour guide said, "Iceland has many natural wonders. As you can see, this waterfall is very historic." Even now, I cannot look at a waterfall without thinking, "Very historic." When we returned to the hotel around 6, sopping wet and bone cold, I begged my friends for a quiet night in. We'd done so much. Couldn't we just order room service and watch some handball highlights and go to bed? But no, the marrow had to be sucked out of life, and so I reluctantly followed my wife and friends out into what would have been the evening, except that in summertime Reykjavik, the sun doesn't set until after 10. We walked to Bayern's Bestu Pilser, the hot dog stand that Julie recommended, and stood in a surprisingly short line outside a small building decorated with an anthropomorphic Frankfurter wearing a chef's hat. I'd been told to order one with everything, and I did, a hot dog with remoulade, sweet mustard, and bits of fried onion. The hot dogs at Bayern's Bestu Pilser are famous. They are featured in travel guides and TV shows. The stand has been rated on a 5-star scale by thousands of Google users. And like anything that has become exceedingly popular, there is widespread backlash. Many reviews point out that this is, after all, just a hot dog. "Nothing too special," one wrote. "Not that good, had better at a gas station," reported a visitor named Doug. Like Doug, I am often disappointed by much-hyped culinary experiences, perhaps because of the weight of expectation, and perhaps because I just don't like food that much. And yet, I found the hot dog at Bayern's Bestu Pilser not just worthy of the hype, but, if anything, underappreciated. I don't even particularly like hot dogs. But that hot dog was among the most joyous culinary experiences of my life. A few months later, in the fall of 2008, an economic recession would sweep the globe, and Iceland would be among the nation's hardest hit, with its currency declining in value by 35% in just a few months. As the recession took hold and credit markets froze, experts said we were experiencing a once-in-a-lifetime economic contraction, although, as it happened, the next once-in-a-lifetime economic contraction was only 12 years away. We should get out of the habit of saying that anything is once in a lifetime. we should stop pretending that we have any idea how long a lifetime is, or what might happen in one. And yet, I suspect that our long day in Iceland really was once in a lifetime. On the chilly summer day, Iceland secured their first ever Summer Olympics team medal. I ate a hot dog while huddled with my friends. It was the greatest hot dog I've ever eaten. It cured my multi-day hangover and cleared the film from my eyes and sent me out into the Reykjavik twilight, feeling the kind of close-to-the-chest joy that can't last, but also doesn't need to. I give Bayern's Bestu Pilsner 5 stars. The Notes app. The iOS Notes app debuted with the first iPhone in 2007. Back then, the app's default font looked vaguely like handwriting and had a yellow background with horizontal lines between each row of text, an attempt to call to mind the yellow legal pads of yore. Even now, the Notes app has a slightly textured background that mimics paper, an example of what's called skeuomorphic design, where a derivative object, say an app, retains now obsolete elements of the original object's design. Casino slot machines, for instance, no longer need a pullable arm, but most still have one. Many mobile device apps use skeuomorphic design. Our calculator apps are calculator-shaped, our digital watches have minute and hour hands, and so on. Perhaps all of this is done in the hopes that we won't notice just how quickly everything is changing. For most of my life, I took notes in the margins of whatever book I happened to be reading. I've never been the kind of person to carry a notebook. I want to be a person who journals, who sits on park benches and has wonderful thoughts that must be immediately captured. But I usually found that my thoughts could wait, and if for some reason I needed to scribble something down, I always had a book with me and a pen in my pocket. There is a grocery list in my copy of Song of Solomon and directions to my great aunt's house in The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. On page 241 of All the King's Men, I wrote at the bottom of the page, "It rains for 2 days straight," an idea I had for the plot of my first novel, Looking for Alaska. There are many other references to my stories in books I was reading. Sometimes it's only a few words, "feral hog hunt," scrawled in the margins of Our Southern Highlanders, became part of the climactic scene in my book An Abundance of Catherines. Usually, though, my marginalia just baffles me. On page 84 of my copy of Jane Eyre, why did I write, "You have never been so lonely"? Was I even the you of that sentence? The note depends on a context I now lack. When I think back to reading Jane Eyre for the first time in college, I don't remember being lonely or whatever else was happening in my daily life. I mostly remember Jane herself, how Rochester called her my sympathy, how Jane said the way to avoid hell was to keep in good health and not die. I first got an iPhone in 2008, but I was slow to abandon my book margin note-taking. I didn't write in the Notes app until 2010, but not long after, I found that I was often leaving home without a pen in my pocket, and eventually I'd often leave home without a physical book in my hand. The problem of having neither pen nor paper was both caused and solved by the iPhone. It occurs to me that technology often brags about solving problems it created. Having a digital library and a note-taking device in my pocket at all times did not make my notes to self any more comprehensible. Why, for instance, did I write in 2011, "They're painting the ceiling of the Rijksmuseum"? were they painting the ceiling of the Rijksmuseum? Or did I think it was a good line for a story? I have no idea. But I can still parse some of the notes. And taken together, they do form a strange kind of autobiography, a way into knowing myself through the lens of what I cared about. Beginning in 2020, I adopted a different note-taking app, leaving Apple's Notes behind. The Notes app is now like the marginalia in that old copy of Jane Eyre, a series of relics. Here is one note I wrote for each year of my life with the Notes app. 2019. Send Manguzo quote to Sarah. More than a dozen of my notes are reminders to send Sarah something, a Donald Hall essay, the catalog for MoCA's Cary James Marshall exhibition, or a joke Henry James wrote about adverbs, the only qualification I really much respect. I don't know how much of this stuff I ever actually shared with her, because things in the Notes app had a way of not getting done. I also don't know which Sarah Manguzo quote I was referring to, but it may have been a passage about life in a psychiatric hospital from Manguzo's book Two Kinds of Decay. The ward was the only true community of equals I have ever lived in. What I mean is that we all knew we had already lived through hell, that our lives were already over, and all we had was the final descent. The only thing to do on the way down was to radiate mercy. 2018. Discontinuity of tense and perspective, hallmark of your time. I have no idea what those words mean, but there they are, typed by me in March of 2018, with no further context. 2017. Driving alone at night is heartbreak without the agony. I had this thought while driving alone at night, and then I pulled over to write it down, which ruined the feeling. 2016. No bright line between imagination and memory. According to my Google Calendar, when I wrote this, I was at the home of my best friends, Chris and Marina Waters. I suspect Sarah probably said a version of that line in conversation, and then I stole it. At any rate, it ended up in my book Turtles All the Way Down, which is about a kid who is constantly remembering what she imagined and imagining what she remembers. 2015. This bar has lights everywhere, but you can't see anybody's face. I sometimes feel like I can't properly participate in conversation because everything I say and hear has to drip through the sieve of my anxiety. And so by the time I understand what someone has just said to me and how I ought to respond, my laughter or whatever seems weirdly delayed. Knowing this will happen makes my anxiety worse, which in turn makes the problem worse. I sometimes deal with it by imagining myself not as part of great conversations, but instead as a chronicler of them. So I pull out my phone and take some notes. This bar has lights everywhere, but you can't see anybody's face, is something a movie star's publicist said to my colleague Elise Marshall when we were all at a hotel bar in Cleveland, Ohio. I liked the line a lot, and I'll probably try to use it in a novel someday. 2014. Strawberry Hill is not the luxury alcohol experience I remember it being. I wrote this after I'd had a bottle of Strawberry Hill, a $4 bright pink wine-like beverage made by Boone's Farm. I often drank Strawberry Hill in high school, and I loved it then, but in the intervening years, either it has changed or I have. One of my favorite sentences in the English language, by the way, comes from a review of Strawberry Hill at the fan website boonesfarm.net. Quote, "Strawberry Hill has a rich, vibrant strawberry flavor with just a hint of hill." 2013. Fire fights fire. This phrase must have mattered to me because I wrote it three separate times in the Notes app in 2013, but I have absolutely no idea what it meant. It's a small reminder now that memory is not so much a camera as a filter. The particulates it holds on to are nothing compared to what leaks through. 2012. Only line meant literally. One day, I was at church, and the gospel reading included Matthew 19:24, which goes, "Again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." The minister said that people take every line of the Bible literally except for that one, when it is the only line that is meant literally. 2011. It was kind of a beautiful day. Only savable sentence. This one I remember quite vividly. I'd spent almost a year working on a novel about six high school students who end up stranded on a desert island. I was stuck with the story, so I decided to take a couple weeks away from it and then reread it. When I returned to it with clear eyes, I found absolutely nothing. No heart, no wit, no joy. It had to be scrapped, except for that one sentence. It was kind of a beautiful day. I still like that sentence, though. It ended up in The Fault in Our Stars. 2010. Her eyes on, his eyes on. According to my phone, this was the first note I made in the app. I assume it was written when I first noticed the pun inside a lyric from my favorite band, the Mountain Goats. Their song Jenny is about a girl who has just acquired a yellow and black Kawasaki motorcycle, and the narrator who loves her. One of the song's couplets goes, "And you pointed your headlamp toward the horizon. We were the one thing in the galaxy God didn't have his eyes on." That line always reminds me of being in 11th grade, lying in the middle of an open field with three friends I loved ferociously, drinking warm malt liquor and staring up at the night sky. Being the one thing in the galaxy God didn't have his eyes on gets a solid 5 stars from me. But as for the Notes app, I give it 3.5 stars. The Mountain Goats. I don't know how to tell you about my love for the band The Mountain Goats, except to say that it is genuinely unconditional. I do not have a favorite Mountain Goats song or album. They are all my favorites. Their songs have been my main musical companion since my friend Lindsay Robertson played me the song "The Best Ever Death Metal Band Out of Denton" half my life ago. Lindsay, who has the best taste of any person I've ever met, recommended I start my Mountain Goats journey by listening to their, at the time, new album, Tallahassee. Like me, Lindsay grew up in Florida. Within a few weeks, I'd memorized every song on Tallahassee. John Darnielle, the band's frontman, is, as music critic Sasha Frere Jones put it, America's best non-hip-hop lyricist. On Tallahassee, he presents love as I was then experiencing it. Quote, "Our love is like the border between Greece and Albania," he sings in International Small Arms Traffic Blues. In another song, he sings of a relationship like a Louisiana graveyard where nothing stays buried. As I got older, the Mountain Goats grew with me. Their songs were with me when my kids were born. Quote, "I saw his little face contract as his eyes met light." And they were with me as I spiraled out of control with grief. Quote, "I am an airplane tumbling wing over wing. Try to listen to my instruments. They don't say anything." Sometimes I need art to encourage me, as the Mountain Goats famously do in the chorus of This Year, with Darnielle shouting, "I am going to make it through this year if it kills me." Other times, I only need art to accompany me. The mountain goats have shaped the way I think and listen so profoundly that I don't know who I would be without them, only that I wouldn't be me. I don't want to overstate it, but there are moments in mountain goat songs that are almost scriptural to me, in the sense that they give me a guide to the life I want to live and the person I wish to be when I grow up. Consider, for instance, this couplet. You were a presence full of light upon this earth, and I am a witness to your life and to its worth. That's a calling to me, to present more light and to better witness the light in others. I give the mountain goats 5 stars. The QWERTY keyboard. On most English language keyboards, the 3 rows of letter keys are not arranged alphabetically or by frequency of use. Indeed, the 2 most common letters in English, E and T, aren't among the so-called home keys where your fingers rest when typing. You've got to reach for them up on the top row where the letters from left to right begin Q, W, E, R, T, Y. The reasons for this involve typewriter mechanics, a militant vegetarian, and a Wisconsin politician who belonged to 3 different political parties in the span of 8 years. I love a straightforward story of inventors and their inventions. In 5th grade, I wrote my first ever work of nonfiction on the life of Thomas Edison. It begins, "Thomas Alva Edison was a very interesting person who created many interesting inventions, like the light bulb and the very interesting motion picture camera." I liked the word interesting because my biography had to be written by hand in cursive, and it had to be 5 pages long, and in my shaky penmanship, interesting took up an entire line on its own. Of course, among the interesting things about Edison is that he did not invent either the light bulb or the motion picture camera. In both cases, Edison worked with collaborators to build upon existing inventions, which is one of the human superpowers. What's most interesting to me about humanity is not what our individual members do, but the kinds of systems we build and maintain together. The light bulb is cool and everything, but what's really cool is the electrical grid used to power it. But who wants to hear a story about slow progress made through iterative change over many decades? Well, you, hopefully. The earliest typewriters were built in the 18th century, but they were both too slow and too expensive to be mass-produced. Over time, the expansion of the Industrial Revolution meant that more precision metal parts could be created at lower costs, and by the 1860s, a newspaper publisher and politician in Wisconsin, Christopher Latham Sholes, was trying to create a machine that could print page numbers onto books when he started to think a similar machine could type letters as well. Sholes was a veteran of Wisconsin politics. He'd served as a Democrat in the Wisconsin State Senate before joining the Free Soil Party, which sought to end legal discrimination against African Americans and to prevent the expansion of slavery in the U.S. Sholes later became a Republican and is most remembered today as a vocal opponent of capital punishment. He led the way toward Wisconsin abolishing the death penalty in 1853. Working with his friends Samuel Soule and Carlos Glidden, Sholes set out to build a typewriter similar to one he'd read about in the magazine Scientific American, which described a literary piano. They initially built their typewriter with 2 rows of keys, ebony and ivory, just like the piano, and a mostly alphabetical key layout. At the time, there were many typewriting machines using many different key layouts and design strategies, which speaks to one of the great challenges of our sprawling species-wide collaborations: standardization. Learning a new key layout every time you get a new typewriter is wildly inefficient. Side note, lack of standardization often hampers productivity. Railroad gauge size is a famous example of the phenomenon, but the one that enters my life most often is charger cables for portable electronic devices. Some of my devices use USB-C charging cables, others use USB-A or mini-USB or micro-USB, and then there's whatever charging standard Apple is using at the moment. Apple has abandoned so many standards over the past decade that it's a blessed miracle they still make computers with QWERTY keyboard layouts. The Scholl's typewriter was a so-called blind writer, meaning you couldn't see what you were typing as you typed it. This meant you also couldn't tell when the typewriter had jammed, and the alphabetical layout of the keys led to lots of jams. But it's not clear these jams were the driving force behind changing the key layout. Koichi and Motoko Yasuoka make a compelling argument in their paper on the prehistory of QWERTY that the layout was not driven by jams, but by the needs of telegraph operators translating Morse code. Regardless, both telegraph operators and stenographers helped shape the eventual keyboard layout, as did a huge array of other collaborators, including Thomas Edison, who offered advice on the typewriter. Scholl's, Soule, and Glidden also relied upon outside investors, most notably Scholl's old friend James Densmore. Densmore was a passionate vegetarian who survived primarily on raw apples and was known for getting into arguments at restaurants whenever he overheard a stranger ordering a meat dish. He also cut his pants several inches above the ankle for comfort, and he happened to have a brother, Amos, who studied letter frequency and combinations in English. According to some reports, Amos advised the typewriter makers on the keyboard layout. Those beta-testing stenographers and telegraph operators were told by Densmore to give the typewriters a good thrashing, find its weak spots. As the beta testers thrashed away, Scholl's and his colleagues refined the machines until by November of 1868, the typewriter used a four-row keyboard in which the top row began AEI?. By 1873, the four-row layout began QWE?.TY. That year, the gun manufacturer Remington & Sons bought the rights to the Scholl's and Glidden typewriter. With the U.S. Civil War over, Remington wanted to expand outside of firearms. Engineers at Remington moved the R to the top row of the typewriter, giving us more or less the same key layout we have today. The QWERTY layout wasn't invented by one person or another, but by many people working together. Incidentally, Scholl's himself found the keyboard layout unsatisfactory and continued to work on improvements for the rest of his life. A few months before his death, he sought a patent for a new keyboard where the top row of letter keys began XPMCH. But it was QWERTY that hung around, in part because the Remington 2 typewriter became very popular, and in part because it's a good keyboard layout. There have been many attempts to improve upon QWERTY in the years since its introduction, but none made a big enough difference to shift the standard. The best-known purportedly easier typing layout is the Dvorak Simplified Keyboard, created in 1932 by August Dvorak, which features AOEU on the left-side home keys. Some studies found that Dvorak's layout improved typing speed and lowered error rates, but many of those studies were paid for by Dvorak, and more recent scholarship has shown little, if any, benefit to the Dvorak or any other purportedly optimized keyboard layout. The QWERTY keyboard, partly by accident, is pretty good at alternating hands within words, which means that one hand can be reaching for a key while the other hand is typing. It's not perfectly efficient. The most common keys are typed by the left hand, whereas most people type slightly faster and more accurately with their right hands. But for most of us, most of the time, QWERTY works. It has certainly worked for me. In elementary school, I had terrible handwriting, hence it taking an entire line of notebook paper to write the word interesting in cursive. No matter how hard I tried to hold the pencil steady, I just couldn't write well. But even as a kid, I was a hell of a typist. Typing on a QWERTY keyboard was one of the first things I ever became good at, initially because I wanted to play the text-based video games of the 1980s, but eventually because I liked the feeling of excellence. By sixth grade, I could type 80 words a minute. These days, I can type as fast as I can think. Or maybe, since I've spent so much of my life thinking through typing, my brain has learned to think at the speed of my typing, just as my brain has learned to think of the alphabet as beginning QWERTY. The keyboard is my path to having thoughts, and also my path to sharing them. I can't play an instrument, but I can bang on this literary piano, and when it's going well, a certain percussive rhythm develops. Sometimes, not every day certainly, but sometimes, knowing where the letters are allows me to feel like I know where the words are. I love the sound of pressing keys on a great keyboard. The technical term is key action. But what I love most about typing is that on the screen or on the page, my writing is visually indistinguishable from anyone else's. As a kid on the early internet, I loved typing because no one could know how small and thin my hands were, or how scared I was all the time, or how I struggled to talk out loud. Online, back in 1991, I wasn't made of anxious flesh and brittle bone. I was made out of keystrokes. When I could no longer bear to be myself, I was able to become, for a while, a series of keys struck in quick succession. And on some level, that's why I am still typing all these years later. So, even though it isn't a perfect keyboard layout, I still give the QWERTY keyboard 4 stars. The world's largest ball of paint. I don't labor under the delusion that the United States is an exemplary or even particularly exceptional nation, but we do have a lot of the world's largest balls. The world's largest ball of barbed wire is in the U.S., as is the world's largest ball of popcorn, and the world's largest ball of stickers, and the world's largest ball of rubber bands, and so on. The world's largest ball of stamps is in Omaha, Nebraska. It was collected by the residents of the orphanage known as Boys Town. I visited the ball of stamps 20 years ago on a road trip with a girlfriend during which we crisscrossed the country seeking out roadside attractions. Our relationship was falling apart, and so we sought a geographical cure. We visited Nebraska's Carhenge, an exact replica of Stonehenge built out of junked cars, and South Dakota's Corn Palace, a massive structure with a facade made primarily of corn kernels. We also visited several of the world's largest balls, including both the world's largest ball of twine rolled by one person in Darwin, Minnesota, and the world's largest ball of twine rolled by a community in Cocker City, Kansas. We broke up soon after, but we'll always have Cocker City. There's an Emily Dickinson poem that begins, "I felt a funeral in my brain." It's one of the only poems I've managed to commit to memory. It ends like this. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing then. Several years ago, a plank in reason broke within me, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge. It wasn't the first time this had happened, but precedent is cold comfort when you feel the funeral in your brain. As I struggled to recover, or at least slow the plunge, my thoughts drifted back to the road trips I'd taken, and I decided to try a geographical cure. I drove to see the world's largest ball of paint, which ended up kind of saving my life, at least for the time being. I'm fascinated by roadside attractions because they are one place where we see the work of huge systems intersect with the work of tiny individuals. We have so many roadside attractions because we have so many roads. Our interstate highway system is built to move lots of people across vast areas of land. It's telling that in the U.S., world's largest balls did not really become a thing until after the highway system was built beginning in the 1950s. Once you're on an interstate, it's easy to stay on it until you need gas or food. To tempt you away from the cruise-controlled straightforwardness of the American highway requires something extraordinary, something unprecedented, the world's largest. So it's the system that makes the roadside attraction necessary, but individuals choose what to make and why. Consider, for example, Joel Wall, creator of Megaton, the world's largest ball of rubber bands. When first constructing the ball, Wall wrote on his MySpace page, "First, have a definite, clear, practical idea, a goal, an objective. Second, have the necessary means to achieve your ends. Third, adjust all means to that end." Aristotle. Aristotle didn't actually write this, but the ideas are distilled from ethics. For Wall, the definite and clear and practical idea was to make the world's largest ball of rubber bands, which would eventually come to weigh over 9,000 pounds. I'm not sure why I find it beautiful to devote oneself obsessively to the creation of something that doesn't matter, but I do. The world's largest ball of paint is located in the tiny town of Alexandria, Indiana. Back in 1977, Mike Carmichael painted a baseball with his 3-year-old son, and then they kept painting it. Carmichael told Roadside America, "My intention was to paint maybe 1,000 coats on it and then maybe cut it in half and see what it looked like. But then it got to the size where it looked kinda neat, and all my family said, keep painting it." Carmichael also invited friends and family over to paint the ball, and eventually strangers started showing up, and Mike would have them paint it too. Now, over 40 years later, there are more than 26,000 layers of paint on that baseball. It weighs 2.5 tons. It has its own little house, and every year more than 1,000 strangers show up to add layers of paint to it. The whole thing is free to visit. Mike even provides the paint. He and his son both still add layers, but most of the painting is done by visitors. As a child, just as I imagine technological advances were driven primarily by the brilliant insights of heroic individuals laboring in isolation, I saw art as a story of individual geniuses. Shakespeare or Leonardo da Vinci or whoever used their innate brilliance to expand the human landscape, and by studying the lives and work of these individuals, I could know all there is to know about how great art gets made. In school, whether I was studying history or math or literature, I was almost always taught that great and terrible individuals were at the center of the story. Michelangelo and his ceiling, Newton and the falling apple, Caesar crossing the Rubicon. To be fair, I was sometimes taught that circumstance played a role in the emergence of greatness. When discussing the adventures of Huckleberry Finn in high school, one of my teachers pointed out that in order for Mark Twain to become Mark Twain, he had to grow up along the river that separated 20th century America during the war that separated 19th century America. But mostly, I was taught and believed that important work was done not by the times or via massive collaboration, but by heroic and brilliant individuals. I still believe in genius, from John Milton to Jane Austen to Toni Morrison. Some artists are just better. But these days, I see genius as a continuum rather than a simple trait. More to the point, I think the worship of individual genius in art and elsewhere is ultimately misguided. Isaac Newton did not discover gravity. He expanded our awareness of it in concert with many others at a time and in a place where knowledge was being built and shared more efficiently. Julius Caesar didn't become a dictator because he chose to cross the Rubicon River with his army. He became a dictator because over centuries, the Roman Republic became more reliant upon the success of its generals to fund the state, and because over time, the empire's soldiers felt more loyalty to their military leaders than to their civilian ones. Michelangelo benefited not just from improved understandings of human anatomy, and not just from being Florentine at a time when Florence was rich, but also from the work of several assistants who helped paint parts of the Sistine Chapel. The individuals we celebrate at the center of more recent revolutions were similarly positioned in times and places where they could contribute to faster microchips, or building better operating systems, or more efficient keyboard layouts. Even the most extraordinary genius can accomplish very little alone. I've often wished, especially when I was younger, that my work was better, that it rose to the level of genius, that I could write well enough to make something worth remembering. But I think that way of imagining art might make individuals too important. Maybe in the end, art and life are more like the world's largest ball of paint. You carefully choose your colors, and then you add your layer as best you can. In time, it gets painted over. The ball gets painted again and again until there is no visible remnant of your paint. And eventually, maybe nobody knows about it except for you. But that doesn't mean your layer of paint is irrelevant or a failure. You have permanently, if slightly, changed the larger sphere. You made it more beautiful and more interesting. The world's largest ball of paint looks nothing like the baseball it used to be, and you're part of the reason. In the end, that's what art is for me. You paint the ball, which changes the way someone else thinks about painting the ball, and so on, until some guy overwhelmed with grief and dread drives out to Alexandria, Indiana, to see what beautiful foolishness thousands of people have made together, and feels a hope that cannot be explained or shared except by painting. The guy adds a layer of his own to the ball, one that won't last, but still matters. Art is not only a genius going forth, as James Joyce put it, to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. Art is also picking a light blue for your layer of the world's largest ball of paint, knowing that it will soon be painted over and painting anyway. I give the world's largest ball of paint 4.5 stars. Sycamore trees. My children like to play an age-old game with me called Why? I'll tell them, for instance, that I need them to finish breakfast, and they'll say, why? And I'll say, so that you can receive adequate nutrition and hydration? And they'll say, why? And I'll say, because as your parent, I feel obligated to protect your health. And they'll say, why? And I'll say, partly because I love you, and partly because of evolutionary imperatives baked into my biology. And they'll say, why? And I'll say, because the species wants to go on. And they'll say, why? And I'll pause for a long time before saying, I don't know. I guess I believe, in spite of it all, that the human enterprise has value. And then there will be a silence. A blessed and beautiful silence will spread across the breakfast table. I might even see a kid pick up a fork. And then, just as the silence seems ready to take off its coat and stay a while, one of my kids will say, why? When I was a teenager, I used the why game as a way of establishing that if you dig deep enough, there is no why. I reveled in nihilism. More than that, I liked being certain about it, certain that everyone who believed life had inherent meaning was an idiot, certain that meaning is just a lie we tell ourselves to survive the pain of meaninglessness. A while back, my brain started playing a game similar to the why game. This one is called What's Even the Point? There's an Edna St. Vincent Millay poem I've quoted in two of my novels, and will now quote again, because I've never come across anything that describes my depressive blizzards so perfectly. That chill is in the air, the poem begins, which the wise know well and have even learned to bear. This joy, I know, will soon be under snow. I'm in an airport in late 2018 when suddenly I feel that chill in the air. What's even the point? I'm about to fly to Milwaukee on a Tuesday afternoon, about to herd with other moderately intelligent apes into a tube that will spew a truly astonishing amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in order to transport us from one population center to a different.